Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe on WVKR. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Patricia Fagan, curator of prints and drawings at the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center at Vassar College, who's here to talk with us about her exhibition, For the People, American Mural Drawings of the 1930s and 1940s, that will be on view through March 11th. Welcome, Patty.
Thank you.
This is primarily a drawing show, but it's also an exhibition that reaches out beyond the objects on view to explore the context in which they were produced. And this is a context of artistic production very different from any that we in the United States have known before or since the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one where the federal government sought not only to provide financial and administrative support for art and artists on a massive scale, but to do so in order to foster a distinctly American art movement that would promote, at least in general terms, New Deal ideals of citizenship, community, progress, and the value of labor. And so before we move on to talk about the specific drawings and artists in the show, I wonder if you could talk a bit about the New Deal art programs in general and what they meant for artists working in the 1930s and 1940s.
Oh, well, sure. There were several art programs that were sponsored by the New Deal. The first one was the Public Works of Art Project, which was called the PWAP. And that was the earliest and really the briefest project. That was in 1933 and 1934, and it lasted for just about 7 months. And that program was for professional, out-of-work artists. And this was a program where the administrators really did pretty much require the subject matter to be American scene subject matter. These artists had been pretty much around for a long time, so this wasn't like the WPA, where so many really young artists, young and financially needy artists, made their murals. But you did have the WPA program, and that was the Federal Art Project that was in existence from 1935 to 1943. And about 2,500 murals were made with that program for public buildings like colleges and universities. Then you also had the section of painting and sculpture, mm-hmm. which was later called the Section of Fine Arts, and that was funded by the U.S. Treasury. And that was from 1934 to about 1943. And that program sponsored murals and sculptures for new post office buildings mm-hmm. and some other new federal buildings throughout the country.
And this wasn't regarded as a relief program in itself, was it?
No.
The Treasury Department, though.
No, really. For the section, the main criteria for artists was the highest quality. So the section sponsored nationwide competitions for their murals and sculptures in different buildings throughout the U.S. And so you had these competitions where the judges didn't know who the artists were. And so you had, you know, the judges choosing works according to the highest quality and not according to the reputation of the artist, per se.
The objects in your exhibition also point beyond themselves in that they're all intermediary works. That is, they're works that are part of a process whose ultimate products were the murals commissioned for post offices, schools, hospitals, and other public buildings, as you mentioned. And so we're necessarily looking at them out of context. We're not only not looking at the finished products, but we're looking at these works in a very different kind of setting than they were conceived for, either as working studies or eventually as public murals. But this is often the case with drawings exhibits, isn't it?
Yes, and that's a very good point about exhibitions that focus on drawings. These drawings really are a means to an end, the end being the mural, the final mural, either done in oil or fresco. And so with most of these drawings, I'd say maybe about 3/4 of them, you don't even see a signature on these drawings. It's because these are working drawings. They're in-process works. And with those competition drawings for the post offices, most of those were anonymous competitions, so you're not going to have the artist's name anyway.
And You have in the exhibition not just working drawings, but you sometimes have photographs of the murals that the drawings were made for and newspaper clippings and other materials to provide historical context.
Right, yes, yes I do. I thought that having as many illustrations as I could find of the final murals would be extremely helpful to people to add a larger context and just to provide more information for them and to have a more well-rounded picture and just some further background. So what I have done is I've tried to find as many illustrations as possible. I actually, this past summer, went out to San Francisco and looked at the Anton Refriger murals there and took my digital camera and took pictures. So,
some of them are
yes,
photographs.
Yes, yes. So people will see my trusty digital photos there up on the wall labels.
Interesting in this regard is the fact that one of the characteristic values of the New Deal art programs in general is their focus on production and process. And part of this is to promote an idea of the artist as a kind of industrial laborer.
Well, the artist was really thought of as a worker during this period, particularly among artists who had an interest in politics or who had a kind of left-leaning social way of looking at the world and at art. But this was a very democratizing time in terms of harsh economics, and the artist was really in the same boat as everybody else.
Yeah.
And he was, and she, they were considered workers to a certain extent.
There is one image, I can't remember exactly what it is, and it may be one of the illustrative items in the show that actually depicts an artist working on a mural, and it's with other laborers.
Right, yeah. That is a photograph of Louis Rubinstein working on his mural called Structure at the Foggar Museum at Harvard. Yeah, and he is working there, and he does, in essence, pay tribute to the other workers or to those workers who actually constructed the wall for him to paint on.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes, yes. So it has a bit of a self-referential kind of effect.
In recent years, certain art historians have remarked that this period in American art provokes a remarkable sort of amnesia in those who write about the history of American modernist art and 20th century art in general. Not that the WPA isn't given some passing credit in these histories for providing artists like Rothko, Pollock, and de Kooning with the physical and social conditions that allowed them to go on and produce the great post-war modernist movement of abstract expressionism that defined and dominated the American art scene into the 60s, but that's about as far as it goes. There really has been very little interest in New Deal art from the traditional art history community, almost as if this were a subject of embarrassment. And I wonder what you think about why this is the case.
You're right. There has been sporadic interest among art historians in this realistic art, the New Deal art of the 1930s and 1940s. And sometimes there is a bit of antagonism, it seems. This antagonism toward realistic art of the 1930s and 40s really began back in the 1930s and 40s, and it's evolved and continued for decades afterwards. And in the latter half of the 1930s, there were heated intellectual debates regarding what was the true American art, or which art was more American, the American scene painting or the social viewpoint in art, which meant social realist or social consciousness painting, or abstract art. And as we know, in the later 40s and then in the 1950s, really abstract art would rise and become the dominant art form.
Yeah.
So these American scene artists and the social realists and the abstract artists all lived side by side and did their work side by side. But in magazines and galleries and newspapers and museums, there were just so many debates about, you know, which one was correct.
It's interesting that the Roosevelt administration took them all into the tent, though.
Well, yes, to a certain degree. Yeah. With artists who were under the Federal Art Project of the WPA, those artists really did have great freedoms to go and do their art without being encumbered, really, by having to do the American Scene style. So you had de Kooning going his way, yeah, and, you know, these other abstract artists like Louis Schenker going his way as well. But then that American Scene subject matter was pretty much the dominant aesthetic for the government art programs.
Yeah. So if we can turn to the artists represented in the exhibition, James Doherty's drawings for his large mural project for the music auditorium of Stamford High School in Stamford, Connecticut, executed in 1934, underscore the programmatic element of New Deal art we mentioned earlier that looks to define the artist, and in this case, the professional musician, as a worker. And I'm thinking of the mural entitled American Rhythm in particular.
Oh, right, yes. Well, that drawing for that mural is a collage, really, of these different spliced scenes of various musicians and singers. And there is this really cubist-like effect. James Doherty had been a modernist and abstractionist in the teens and the 20s. And so he did look back to cubism in making this great, spirited drawing that looks like he did it really, really fast.
Doherty, I know, is a trained muralist, but he was also an illustrator and a cartoonist. And interestingly, cartooning is one of the few readily accessible forms of political art we're still familiar with. Do cartoon artists generally have much influence in the formulation of the style and content of American art in the early 20th century and on New Deal art in particular, do you think?
Well, it isn't that cartoonists, per se, or cartoon artists have an influence. It's that so many of these artists, including Doherty and Rubinstein and Refrigé, started off as cartoonists during their very, very early years. And so when they did some of these mural studies, these mural drawings, and these very early mural drawings, they used the skills that they had learned in their cartoon work of drawing fast, yeah, drawing in an exaggerated fashion in order to get really the essence of a figure. And drawing in simple lines as well. So a kind of simple, concise, essential, exaggerated line is what they learned from their cartoon work. And that has been really translated into some of these drawings, and viewers will really be able to see the roots of these drawings going back to some of these artists' cartoons.
Yeah, it really does seem to transfer nicely into the mural medium because it's two-dimensional and it's narrative.
Right, but at the same time, the final murals and these preliminary drawings, there's a very, very big marked contrast between the finished mural and the drawing.
And the sketch, yeah.
Yeah. And Doherty, whereas he used these other methods to get to the heart of his sketch, he used the American Scene style for his painting. And so those are very melodious, vibrant, and very colorful paintings of figures, yeah, that don't have really this cubist air about them.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So really there is this complex nature to Doherty's work and to some of the other artists' work, of course.
Yeah. Doherty's project is for an educational institution, and I know education was an important aspect, at least theoretically speaking, of the New Deal art programs. Holger Cahill, who was in charge of the Federal Art Project of the WPA, was a vocal adherent of the pragmatic educational philosophy of John Dewey, I know, who believed art had an important social function as a force for education and that it should speak to everyone. And I wonder, do you see education as an important element in the New Deal art programs in terms of practice?
Yes, so many of the murals were done for colleges and universities.
Yeah.
as well as high schools. And the artists would frequently use students and staff and administrators and faculty as their models. And also, artists, as they were painting, would have students right there, you know, just watching the artists paint. And so this was a really very good lesson for, say, high school students who might be interested in art and were, you know, would have been fascinated watching this artist's work.
Another rather spectacular drawing in the exhibition, done for an educational institution, is Milton Belin's study for an office scene, the mural of which was executed in 1940 for the entrance hall of the main building of the Teachers College of Connecticut, which is now Central Connecticut State University. And this is one of those examples, isn't it, where the artist used students as his models?
Yes, he did. So students were able to watch him as he painted his murals, and students could learn just firsthand how an artist works and how an artist made a mural. Yeah, this was very important for artists to share their works, and particularly if an artist was paid by the U.S. government, as Belin's salary was paid. It was really important to connect to those students who were his audience.
Now, you mentioned in your notes to the exhibition that many of the works in the Loeb collections aren't wholly representative of the bulk of the mural projects done for the New Deal, especially in terms of American scene painting. And Belin's drawing seems not exactly to be promoting the dignity of labor in this work, in this case, the world of business.
Right, yes. This was his panel on business education. And this panel shows students, women students, in an office setting, one of whom is working very, very hard, while the other ones seem to be daydreaming a bit.
Yeah, they all have their eyes closed, I know.
Yes.
And they all have their backs to one another, which
yes,
is interesting.
Yes.
Also, the one woman that is working, she's working with a dictaphone machine, and there's another woman who's speaking into it, but almost as though she's smelling a flower. The microphone
yes.
looks like a little flower.
That's right.
And what struck me about this was this is communication technology, and a lot of New Deal art features communications technology of one kind or another, especially post
That's
offices.
True.
And in this case, though, the technology is a disjunctive technology that separates people. It doesn't bring them together.
Right. Well, yes. Well, that drawing has a very subjective air about it, a very inward and introspective air, which is just a bit different from your ordinary American scene.
Yeah.
Painting. Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful drawing, but it does still have this subjective mood and atmosphere. But it's important to know that around 1940, when this drawing was made, there was this inward mood or atmosphere that was seeping into so much American art. During this period, 1940, so many of these artists in the U.S. who were painting in the American scene style, they were also hearing about the war in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and they were just beginning to question themselves, so many of them, about whether or not this aesthetic of recording local scenes was really as important or as significant as perhaps what artists were feeling inside. So this introspection really did become a part of art around this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going from the Great Depression to World War II.
That's right.
Speaking of education, the temporary studies in the exhibit by Ben Shahn I found interesting in this regard, since they were for a mural about the history of Wisconsin that relate the ideals of the Progressive Party, in which the interests of agricultural and industrial laborers were brought together, to developments in higher education, including the very public battle over academic freedom at the University of Wisconsin. And this is depicted on the right-hand side of the more inclusive study, as well as in a detailed study in the exhibit, in the representation of the president of the University of Wisconsin, Clarence Dykstra, holding a written copy of the university's statement on academic freedom, which was the subject of bitter contention for over almost 20 years, as progressives in the state and in the university, and in particular the class of 1910, sought to delimit the practices of the regents of the university from firing faculty on political grounds and prohibiting research that threatened their personal financial interests. some of the regents had interest in utility companies and in particular water companies that were being jeopardized by research being done at the university that was indicating that the state should take over or at least regulate water distribution. So I found Sean's work particularly interesting after our talk last week on the Library Cafe with the educational historian Grace Roosevelt, where she spoke about the way higher education is again facing these kinds of economic and political challenges. And one of the things that struck me about Sean's plan for this mural is the importance he places on this victory of the Academy in the larger scheme of things, where it counts as a political victory that is part and parcel to the elevation of labor by progressives like Robert La Follette, who appears on the left-hand side of the mural.
Right. Well, I must tell you that what drew me to this sketch and then the detailed study by Sean was this very small portrait of La Follette on the left side. And he's a political leader I'm interested in because of his progressive politics. And I recognized his portrait right off.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And so those two paintings are on loan to us from the Rosenfeld Gallery in New York. So without knowing this history of the pledge to academic freedom, I went ahead and asked to borrow those two paintings just on the knowledge that here was a politician who had run for president and was head of the Progressive Party. And I wanted these two paintings to be in my section on political expression, and I thought that they would fit right in.
It's funny the way La Follette's memory has been effaced in American history. In his time, he was at least as well known as Huey Long for the same kind of populism.
Yes, very well known.
But unfortunately, the mural wasn't painted, so
no.
that legacy wasn't passed on, I guess.
Right, and just to add, several of the mural drawings in the show were not chosen to be made into murals, so it's quite interesting, that aspect too.
Now, the public art of the New Deal programs is very much influenced by public taste and expectations, which I know differed remarkably from region to region and community to community across the United States, as one would expect. And there were controversies over style as well as content. However, modernist elements weren't always rejected out of hand, were they?
Right, and particularly under the WPA, modernist elements were not rejected out of hand. But then also you had a very big program like the murals that were done for the various buildings at the New York World's Fair, and several of those were modernist in nature. There were murals by de Kooning and Shanker, and various other modernists. Arshil Gorky's wonderful bold little drawing that is in the exhibition was not chosen for the Marine Transportation Building at the New York World's Fair.
There was an association with the public, wasn't there, between abstract treatments in these murals and technological progress?
Right. There really did seem to be, particularly with the New York World's Fair murals, since that was a fair that was really equated with the future of America, but you're seeing that today, those futuristic aspects really did mesh quite well with abstract painting, particularly painting that was really based on biomorphic forms or abstract forms.
Besides technology and industrialization, agriculture is an important theme in many of these works. And one of the works in the exhibition that really seems to typify this is Andre Ruelin's Delhi post office design for the 48 state mural competition.
Right. This is a really very lively color sketch by Andre. And she lived in Shady, just outside of Woodstock. And she would have seen the announcement for the 48 state competition that was sponsored by the section. And so she would have seen that, and she would have noticed those post offices that were close by candidates, to her in terms of geography. So Delhi is not very far away from Shady or from Woodstock. And it was the plan, or really one of the goals of the 48 States competition, was to have artists work on these post office murals who really were close by. But yes, this is an idyllic rural scene of generations playing and working there in this kind of foothills atmosphere.
And did I hear that you were able to meet Andre Ruelen?
Yes, yes. Actually, I met her back in 1996 when I was at the University of Georgia and did a study on the American scene and the South. And she came to speak then, and that's how I met her. And then in these past few years, I've gone to her house and talked with her.
Mm-hmm. Ruelen belonged to the Woodstock Artist Colony, whose members appear to have played an important role in the New Deal art programs in general.
Well, yes. Woodstock is, of course, a wonderful, wonderful artist colony. And during the 30s and 40s, the Woodstock Artist Colony was one of the leading artist colonies in the U.S. And these artists, they lived in Woodstock, but so many of them also lived in New York. And they felt the pulse of the different styles that were happening then in American art of the 1930s and 40s. And not only Andre Ruelen, but we're also talking about Judson Smith, whose work is in the exhibition, and Anton Refrigé and some others. Yeah. And, of course, Marion Greenwood.
Anton Refrigé was one of the best-known New Deal mural artists painting during this period, and there are several of his drawings in the exhibit, some from his History of San Francisco, a work that even Richard Nixon couldn't manage to get covered over.
Right. Refrigé's murals out in San Francisco at the Rincon Annex of the San Francisco Post Office, so many of those panels were controversial. Mm-hmm. They caused controversy because several of them were pro-labor, and a few of them showed scenes of Chinese immigrants being beaten. Mm-hmm. These kind of very realistic and topical scenes disturbed conservative groups in California and disturbed them to a degree that these leaders in the community were able to have a subcommittee hearing in Washington at the House of Representatives regarding whether or not the murals would be destroyed or saved. And so not only was the subject matter of, or the controversial subject matter of Refrigé's murals brought as evidence, so to speak, but also Refrigé was a politically leftist artist, and his politics was called into question, too, by many of these groups. And this was in 1953, when a time when this nationalistic wave of patriotism was
McCarthy hearings.
The McCarthy hearings, the McCarthy era, was passing over the United States. And so this is a very difficult time, but the art world did come to the rescue, and they galvanized a great deal of public support as well. And the resolution to destroy Refrigé's murals never came out of the subcommittee and, in effect, saving the murals.
It's interesting that so many of the murals, and I expect it's part of the agenda of the New Deal art programs in general, teach history or make an historical record. I suppose because people at the time were feeling that the end of the world was nigh. I mean, the Depression was really a cataclysmic event in the lives of most Americans across the board, no matter what their social standing or economic standing. You know, when the stock market crashed, everybody was threatened. And history seems to me to have been one way to send a message that there is continuity, that these things happen to people, but the nation will go on, isn't that
right.
The case? And Refrigé seems to have taken his historical tasks very seriously, and that he wanted to actually document things that had happened.
Right, yes. He actually started his mural project in San Francisco back in 1941, and then it wasn't finished until 49. Because of the war, it took a very long time for him to finish. But he was very, very interested in showing the different historical episodes of San Francisco and California history, but not only showing the good things, but also the bad things as well. And many conservative groups, they would have rather seen a more idealized public art rather than a more realistic one.
Yeah. It's interesting that many New Deal murals, such as Refugee's San Francisco Project, seem to inspire a kind of historical record of their own in terms of the controversies they create and the wider social and political battles for which they become contested sites. Diego Rivera's Rockefeller Center mural comes to mind in this.
Right, that's right.
In the show, Charles Alston's mural for Harlem Hospital was one of these contested sites where we find racial prejudices involved.
Yes, that's right. Charles Alston was an African-American artist who had become the supervisor of the WPA mural program at Harlem Hospital. And so what he did was to design these two murals with black subject matter, where the black subject matter dominated the two panels. And actually, the white superintendent of Harlem Hospital objected to the dominance of this subject matter. His reasoning was, well, perhaps Harlem will become white, in 50 years' time. Yeah. But actually, Alston was following what he should have been following, because he chose subject matter that connected to the community there in Harlem, which was predominantly black. Mm. And so that was his argument, and that was the argument of him as well as all the different groups that supported him. And so finally, 4 years after he had done the designs, the paintings were installed. But it took 4 years.
Are they still there, do you know?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Another artist in the exhibit whose work often contains political themes is Louis Rubinstein, who taught painting here at Vassar for many years, and whom I remember coming into the art library back many years ago when I first started.
Periodically. Yes, he taught in 1939 and then from 1946 to 1974, so a very long time.
He was a major figure among New Dealers, wasn't he? He was
well-known. He was a well-known artist. He had gone to Harvard and had done several murals there, a few of which caused quite a bit of controversy. Yeah.
You mentioned briefly Marion Greenwood a few minutes ago as a Woodstock artist. She studied and worked as a mural artist in Mexico.
Yes. Well, she worked in Mexico. Mm-hmm. She really didn't study in Mexico. I mean, she did go around and look at Diego Rivera's murals. But yes, she was a mural artist in Mexico, and she did some really monumental and phenomenal murals in Mexico. Her first major mural was done in Morelia for the university there. And then the second one was this series of panels that she did that were really quite large and actually propagandistic. And those were done for a new market that had been constructed. And she was only one person, one artist among several, including her sister and some other artists who made murals there. But that mural program at that market in Mexico City, that was overseen by Diego Rivera. He was the advisor for that mural project. And in fact, in one of the drawings in the show, you can see his signature on one of them, on one of Marion Greenwood's drawings, is because he had to approve those drawings before the mural could go forward.
Rivera and the Great Revolutionary Mural Art Program, sponsored by the Mexican government that began in the early 1920s, had a profound effect on the whole formulation of the New Deal art projects, didn't it?
Yes, very, very much so. In fact, it was George Biddle, an artist and a friend and former classmate of FDR, who strongly suggested and recommended that FDR really sponsor a program for artists in the U.S. like there had been a program for artists in Mexico.
Now, last question. There are also in the exhibit sketches for federal mural art projects in Poughkeepsie and Rhinebeck?
Yes, that's true. There is a mural sketch by Judson Smith that was done for the Poughkeepsie Post Office, and as some of your listeners will know, his mural did not make it. But you can still go today, though, and see the murals that are there in the Poughkeepsie Post Office. Also, there are a couple of sketches by Olin Dowles for the Rhinebeck Post Office, and those murals are still there at the Rhinebeck Post Office. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Rhinebeck Post Office is just a wonderful example of this period, not only architecturally, but also in terms of Olin Dowell's, his program there of murals, where he devoted his scheme to the history of the area and did so in a really beautiful manner.
FDR took a personal interest in that project, did he know? Yeah.
Yes. FDR was from Dutchess County, and he was very interested in these specific post offices, the Poughkeepsie Post Office, as well as the Rhinebeck and Hyde Park Post Offices.
Yeah. Are there other murals in the vicinity that are accessible from this period? I know the Poughkeepsie Journal has a mural.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, the Poughkeepsie Journal does have this very impressive mural, and there are also murals in other areas. In Wappingers Falls, there is a mural mm-hmm. there as well.
I want to thank you, Patty, for visiting us today on the Library Cafe and talking about the federal mural projects.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It was great fun. We've been talking with Patricia Fagan, curator of prints and drawings at the Francis Lehman Loeb Arts Center at Vassar College, about the exhibition now on view until March 11, entitled For the People, American Mural Drawings of the 1930s and 1940s. You're listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR Independent Radio 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie. I'm your host, Thomas Hill.